from Pacifica. This is Democracy Now! In defense of our America, the fight for civil liberties in the age of terror. Today, our guest is Anthony Romero, executive director of the ACLU. On U.S. killing of civilians in Iraq, we'll look at psychologists' involvement in interrogations, and we'll talk to him about the case of John Walker Lynn, among others. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Congress's chief auditor has issued a scathing report warning Iraq's political and security situation is bleak. The Government Accountability Office report found Iraq had successfully met only 3 of 18 benchmarks set by Congress. Overall, Iraq has failed to meet 11 of the U.S. benchmarks and had partially met 4 of the goals. David Walker, controller of the GAO, presented his findings Tuesday.
As of August 30th, 2007, the Iraqi government had met 3, partially met 4, and did not meet 11 of the 18 benchmarks. Overall, key legislation has not been passed, violence remains high, and it is unclear whether the Iraqi government will spend the $10 billion in reconstruction funds it has allocated.
The original GAO report painted an even harsher picture of Iraq, but the findings were partially rewritten under pressure from the White House. Residents of the Iraqi city of Basra are continuing to celebrate following the withdrawal of British troops from the Basra Palace. Britain's expected to fully leave Basra as early as next month. British Lieutenant Colonel Patrick Sanders predicted violence in Basra would decrease after the troop withdrawal.
By and large, and I'm reasonably optimistic here, I hope that by removing ourselves from Basra, quite a lot of the focus of violence, which is directed at us, over 90% of the attacks are against British forces, then Basra will become a calmer and less violent place.
British journalist Patrick Coburn reports even after 4 years in Basra, the British military controlled few parts of the city. Security has now been handed over to the Iraqi security forces, which is largely controlled by Shia militias. Coburn describes Britain's effort in Basra as one of the most futile campaigns ever fought by the British Army. Talk about a U.S. attack on Iran appears to be growing louder in Washington. There are reports that Vice President Dick Cheney's office has issued instructions to conservative think tanks to start a drumbeat for attacking Iran. On Monday, the American Enterprise Institute is hosting 2 events related to Iran. Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich is giving a speech on how the war on terrorism should be viewed as a, quote, world war that pits civilization against terrorists and their state sponsors who wish to impose a new dark age. Later in the day, former CIA Director Jim Woolsey and others will meet to discuss a new book by longtime Iran hawk Michael Ledeen entitled The Iranian Time Bomb, The Mullah Zealots, Quest for Destruction. The Heritage Foundation recently hosted an interagency Bush administration war game attempting to anticipate Iranian responses to U.S. bombing campaign. Meanwhile, the Sunday Times of London has reported the Pentagon has drawn up plans for massive airstrikes against 1,200 targets in Iran designed to annihilate the Iranians' military capability in 3 days. The main source of the article is an official at another conservative Washington think tank, the Nixon Center. Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega has declared a state of emergency in the wake of Hurricane Felix. The Category 5 storm made landfall Tuesday. It damaged 5,000 homes and left 30,000 people homeless. Meanwhile, on the Pacific coast, Hurricane Henriette hit the Baja California Peninsula in Mexico. This marks the first time since record-keeping began that 2 hurricanes made landfall on the same day. And 2007 has become the first year ever in which 2 Category 5 hurricanes made landfall. Many scientists say there's a direct correlation between the stronger storms and the increased sea surface temperatures caused by global warming. In Greece, about 2,000 demonstrators marched through Athens Tuesday to protest the government's handling of the country's unprecedented forest fires. The fires killed over 60 people, left thousands homeless, destroyed whole villages, and turned thousands of acres of forest to ashes. Many Greeks believe the fires were set by rogue developers trying to make way for new construction in forest land. Environmental campaigners have also said there might be a connection between the fires and global warming. This is Greek protester Karalia Karali.
The citizens have to develop an environmental conscience because we are convinced the politicians don't have one. If they did, they would have taken swift measures so this catastrophe would not happen.
Scientists have predicted subtropic zones such as South Greece and the American Southwest will become hotter, drier, and more likely to suffer drought as global warming intensifies. In the West Bank, Palestinians in the town of Bilin celebrated Tuesday following the Israeli Supreme Court's decision to reroute part of the Israel's 425-mile wall through the West Bank. For nearly 3 years, Palestinian activists have staged weekly protests against the wall because it divides the town and cuts it off from nearby farming land. This is protest leader Rateb Abu Rama.
The decision of the Israeli High Court today means a lot to us. The fruit of our 2.5-year struggle. It was a continuous struggle in the village of Bilin. Today we reap the fruits of that struggle.
The attorney for the Palestinian villagers, Michael Sfard, hailed the High Court ruling.
The Israeli Supreme Court has accepted all of the arguments that Bilin village has introduced. The court has accepted that the root of the wall that goes on the lands of the village of Bilin was not decided according to security needs, but according to the desire to expand the illegal settlement of Modi'in Elite. That was the decision of the court.
Jewish settlers criticized the court, saying it would jeopardize their security. This is Avraham, a resident of the Modi'in Elite settlement near Bilin.
The Jewish people have to first and foremost worry about the Jews. And here's the feeling that they're worrying about the Arabs. That's a difficult feeling that's accompanying us on this day with this ruling, and this ruling hurts us a lot.
In campaign news, former Republican Senator Fred Thompson is expected to officially announce his entry into the Republican presidential race Thursday. Earlier this week, in an interview on Fox News, Thompson warned a withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq would result in the entire region obtaining nuclear weapons. Thompson did not describe how this would actually happen. Currently, Israel is the only country in the Middle East with nuclear weapons. In other political news, Senator Larry Craig is reportedly reconsidering his decision to resign after his arrest in a Minnesota airport sex sting. On Saturday, Craig said he intends to resign at the end of the month, but a spokesperson said last night he may still fight for his Senate seat. A demonstration is scheduled this morning at DePaul University in Chicago to protest the school's denial of tenure to Professors Norman Finkelstein and Maureen LaRudy. Students are also criticizing DePaul's last-minute decision to cancel Professor Finkelstein's classes for this semester. Before the rally, Professor Finkelstein is expected to meet with students who had signed up to take his two courses, one called Freedom and Empowerment, the other Equality and Social Justice. Finkelstein has said DePaul's decision to deny him tenure was a result of political opposition to his speaking out about the Israel-Palestine conflict. For years, Professor Finkelstein has been one of the most prominent critics of the Israeli government in American academia. Here in New York, the city's first public Arabic school opened Tuesday under police guard. 60 sixth graders attended the first day of classes at the Khalil Gibran International Academy. The school is one of 200 small schools in the city specializing in foreign language, but no other such school has faced so much opposition and media criticism. In recent months, the school's founding principal was forced to resign, and the school's location was moved. Opponents of the school have attempted to portray the Arabic language school as a breeding ground for terrorists. In other news from New York, some of the city's taxi drivers have begun a two-day strike to protest new rules requiring all cabs to have global positioning systems and touchscreen monitors that'll let passengers pay by credit card. Some cabbies fear the GPS systems could be used to track their movements and that they could get stuck paying hefty fees for credit card processing. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A Louisiana judge has refused to overturn the conviction of Michael Bell. Bell and five other African-American teens were arrested after a schoolyard fight in which a white student was beaten and suffered a concussion. The fight followed months of escalating tension in the town of Gina, Louisiana. Nooses had been hung from a schoolyard tree where the black students had sat. The Gina Six, as they've come to be known, were initially charged with attempted murder. Michael Bell is the only student tried so far. An all-white jury found him guilty of second-degree battery and conspiracy in June. On Tuesday, Judge J.P. Malfrey let the conviction stand despite ruling Michael Bell was improperly tried in adult court instead of as a juvenile. Bell's conspiracy charge was dismissed, but he still faces up to 15 years in prison. Thousands of supporters from across the country are expected to gather for a rally in Gina when Michael Bell is sentenced on September 20th. Meanwhile, prosecutors also announced they've reduced the attempted murder charges against two others among the Gina Six. Carwin Jones and Theo Shaw are also now charged with aggravated second-degree battery and conspiracy. Two other students, Robert Bailey Jr. and Brian Purvis, await trial for attempted murder. Well, Democracy Now! Traveled to Gina over the weekend to cover this story. And I spoke to Theo Shaw and Robert Bailey at their home in Gina. They were ironing their clothes to preparing to go out for the evening. Robert and Theo were held for about 8 months in prison until their families raised the money to bail them out. Theo was just released over a month ago on more than $100,000 bail. I began by asking Theo to describe his time in jail.
They maced one time. He was on March the 14th. I had asthma. I told them they already knew this. And I had an asthma attack. They rushed me to the emergency room.
And where did the asthma come from? You know what I mean?
Where it come from? My asthma.
Yeah, what triggered it?
I couldn't breathe.
What triggered it? What made it happen that night?
The mace.
So the police, the jail, the guards would mace you in the prison cell?
Yes, ma'am.
Why?
Sometimes when they make a lot of noise, they mace. And sometimes it just makes for no reason.
How many of you were in a cell?
Six, but they had the doors open and we all go in each other's cell. Like 12. Six on this side, six on this side. We walking in like six.
Did they mace you a lot?
Yes, ma'am.
You told them you had asthma?
They already knew. It happened one more than one time.
When they had to bring you to the hospital?
I went to the hospital once, but I went to the doctor a couple times.
Can you give me a shoe?
What happens when you get maced? What does it feel like?
I got asthma. I couldn't breathe.
It took them forever to come back there. I had to holler like 30 times. You know, you bang on a wall with that spray. So I'm banging on the wall. I'm like, he can't breathe, he can't breathe. So I'm like kicking, I'm kicking. I'm kicking on the wall, I'm jumping in front of the camera. I'm like, what you want? They're gonna spray me, so I'm running like, you know, he got ALM test, ALM test. They rushed over there, they found out. They didn't want to believe it at first, I don't know.
So you guys were kept in the same cell?
At first, they had
separate. They tried to separate us. They didn't want us to be together.
For like the first month.
Then we ended up getting together. And everybody started getting out.
How hard has all this been on you?
Hard time.
Do you think you'll be able to finish high school?
Yes, ma'am.
How will you do it?
If I had to get home school or something, I got to finish. I want to go to Grambling.
Where do you want to go?
Grambling State University.
I asked Theo to think back to September 2006 when the nooses were hung in the schoolyard tree. I asked him what the nooses meant to him and how they made him feel.
A threat. We gonna kill you. We don't want you around here. That's how I looked at it.
The nooses came after someone, a black student, asked the principal if black students could sit under the tree?
Yeah, the next day.
So what did you all do in reaction to that when you saw the nooses?
Stopped under the tree and questioned a lot of white students.
Someone told us that the black students thought it was funny. Did you think it was funny?
I didn't.
I asked Theo and Robert if they were surprised to find the nooses on the tree the day after the black students dared to sit in its shade.
Yes, ma'am.
Why did it surprise you?
Because I didn't think we might have a guest to do that. Not at a schoolhouse.
The students weren't expelled. They were suspended. Do you know the students? Three students.
I know.
What did you think should have happened to them?
They should have got expelled.
Why?
Because it wasn't a prank. It was a threat. Where's my shirt?
Robert, what did you think about the nooses?
I don't know. Oh, man. Everybody was mad about the nooses.
What did they mean to you?
The first thing came to my head was the KKK. I don't know why. That was the first thing that came to my head. So I used to always think the KKK chased black people on horses and they catch with rope. I don't know why I was thinking like that. But that was the first thing that came to my head.
And what did you think about the students being suspended?
The whole school was mad, not just black people. Just the whole school was mad. It was some white boys who wanted to fight them boys from hanging the nooses and stuff once they came back.
White boys, you said, wanted to fight them as well as blacks.
Yes, ma'am.
And what did you think should have happened to the students?
They should have got the same thing we got. They should have been equal. If we got expelled out of school, they should have got the same thing. It shouldn't have been no second chance. They gave them a second chance to come back to school. We didn't get a chance to get out of their education.
Are you going to try to finish high school?
I hope I do.
Why is that important to you?
Because I just want to go to school, and I just want to play sports. I want to get my education first, but I still want to play sports, too.
You want to stay in junior?
I don't know. It's all right sometimes. I don't think I want to stay in junior.
Did what happened in September with the nooses hung there, did that change your view of junior?
No, they didn't change my view.
What does it feel like to be called one of the genus sex?
It makes some of us feel like we're famous, but you don't give me no feeling called genus sex.
How's it feel to come out of jail?
Great. Just to walk free.
Yeah.
And eat what you want.
What's the first thing you did when you got out?
Just went to see my grandma.
Have you heard about what's it meant to you that other people have been organizing to help support you?
I got the right answer.
I'm just thankful for the appreciation and all the help that we get.
Were you surprised when you heard about the defense committee and the protest march? And has that surprised you?
Yes, sir.
What's surprising about it?
Then we got people just not scared to stand up for what's right.
Theo Shaw and Robert Bailey, two of the Gina Six. The first will be sentenced on September 20th, Michael Bell. He faces more than 15 years in prison. We went to Democracy Now! With producer Anjali Kamat, journalist David Goodman, and filmmakers Jackie Suin and Rick Rowley. We went together to Gina, Louisiana, this weekend. We're joined by American Civil Liberties Union Executive Director Anthony Romero to talk about a number of issues. But for just a minute, it's great to have you with us. What about the Gina Six? The ACLU is involved.
Well, it clearly points to the continued discrimination and the whole climate of racism in post-Katrina, as we celebrate the anniversary of the Katrina events. And you see now also the difficulty of the persistence of race, especially in local communities. The idea that these young men, these boys in high school, are being treated also as adults, where they're being sentenced for potential sentences in prisons that go so much further than anyone had ever contemplated. Also raises questions around crime and punishment. especially when you're poor minority. And so those are still the most vexing questions that we contend with as a society.
We're going to break, and then we'll come back and talk about these questions here in this country and around the world, America's effect on the world. Anthony Romero, our guest for the hour, executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union. We'll be back in a minute.
Can change like a name, and only to run single frames where I'm from, the least to be claimed is betrayed. And I understand, just include what's been done, the lesson still hangs from my wall. The hovering there, looking life as some bear, is not what you want to become. But then there's life. Everything you gave, everything I have. How can I complain around you here? Have what I can give, just something to try, so everyone can see that you're just like me.
Jeff Hansen, Just Like Me. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM, college and community radio stations, on public access TV stations and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks. On Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on 375 on DirecTV, also Link. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish, and our website and transcript and audio form for any radio station to take, as over 150 are around the world. You can, too. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, we are talking to the head of the American Civil Liberties Union, which is making public nearly 10,000 pages of documents chronicling civilian casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan. The files include courts-martial proceedings and military investigations regarding the possible wrongful death of civilians. The ACLU obtained the records from the Department of the Army after filing a Freedom of Information Act request over a year ago. But the Pentagon has so far refused to comply with the request. The ACLU is now filing a lawsuit demanding the Pentagon release the documents. Anthony Romero is executive director of the ACLU, and he's just written a new book. It's called In Defense of Our America, The Fight for Civil Liberties in the Age of Terror. The book chronicles scores of individual cases that Romero says mark the front lines of the fight for civil liberties in the post-9/11 United States. Anthony Romero is with us here for the hour. Welcome to Democracy Now! Again.
Thank you.
So let's talk about these documents you just got and didn't get.
Well, FOIA for us has been the only way to really to pull out information from the government that about the war in Iraq, about the war on terror, about the surveillance program. And we've used FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act, as democracy's X-ray, as a way to cast a light into that black box that especially the Bush administration has tried to keep so closed, and to wrangle loose some documents that help us understand better what's going on behind the curtain, behind the scenes in the government. These most recent documents around civilian deaths in Iraq, we know the difficulty of covering the war in Iraq, especially the journalists who've had difficulty covering it because both of the potential for violence and also the potential for getting clearance from the government. We know that the journalists have been blocked from taking photographs of the returning coffins coming back of the soldiers coming back to the United States. And so for us, when we read about the especially the Haditha civilian the massacre, we wanted to make sure that we can get as many documents that are within the government's possession that show civilian deaths in Iraq. It would be a way to paint a fuller picture. This is also in light of the fact that Mr. Cheney would make some statements that were really truly galling. When the press would ask him questions around civilian deaths, he said, "We don't count the deaths of Iraqis. We were only obviously counting deaths of American soldiers," is what he was meant to say. And so for us, the idea of wrangling loose some of these documents paint a very different picture of what's going on. It shows soldiers are often very confused about how to conduct the war in Iraq, that are fearful for their lives, that there are poor policies put in place, especially around some of the checkpoints. There's a series of stories of vignettes of how the civilians actually were killed in their interface with soldiers. There's one story, Amy, that is harrowing. There's a story of a young man whose entire family, his mother, father, brother, were gunned down as they slept in their house. And then behind the house, an entire flock of sheep, 15 sheep, were also all killed. So you think about the level of force that had to have been used in order to kill his family in the house, an entire flock of sheep behind him. It really raises questions around the use of excessive force as they slept. There's another story about this, and the stories are what perhaps are most poignant about some of these documents. And government documents tend to be rather dry, and yet in the investigative reports that go into some of the details, there was a young boy who was shot down because they thought his school satchel was a bomb. I believe he was about 9 years old. I think his uncle got $500 of compensatory payment as a result of the young boy's death. There's a story about two fishermen in the Tikrit River who are there fishing, and they realize that there's a helicopter overhead, and they realize that they perhaps are being seen as a potential threat. And so the fisherman picks up a fish and starts waving, fish, 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 and turns over to turn off the engine of the boat, and that's when they shoot him down. And all of these vignettes point to the fact that this is really a war in chaos, that the soldiers often don't understand how to interact with the civilian population, and the civilian population doesn't understand how to interact with the soldiers.
And you have Haditha, 2005, what was it, 24 people killed, some young men in a car who had gotten out, who were, I think they were college students,
right.
And then you have the families who are in their houses, and
right.
They're gunned down, the men, the women, the children.
And we just read about some of the prosecutions on the Haditha massacre, in fact, falling apart in this last week or so. There were some press reports in the New York Times and elsewhere. And what it shows is that there is difficulty. There are obviously mistakes will be made in a war, and especially on the front lines. But there's also policy decisions that have not been made or have been made poorly. The fact that there's so much confusion and so much violence at checkpoints, I think, should indicate to us that there's got to be better training and better understanding about when military forces interact with civilians at checkpoints, that we need to be clear about what that interface should be like.
And deaths during interrogations?
Well, that's the big FOIA litigation, Freedom of Information Act litigation that we brought early on. We brought this lawsuit in October of 2003. This was even before any of the photographs came out to light about Abu Ghraib. And we just had a hunch. I mean, it was just your typical ACLU lawyer hunch that whenever you lock away prisoners in places that lawyers and family members and the press can't get to, that bad things are likely to happen. And so we filed this very broad FOIA request, asking the government to turn over any and all documents related to torture and abuse in any of the places where they have individuals detained. And that would cover, obviously, Guantanamo, it would cover Bagram, it would cover questions later on in Iraq, or facilities in Iraq. And initially there was a great debate within the organization. I mean, some of the more senior lawyers didn't think that they would get any information out of this lawsuit. It was a young lawyer actually who brought the suit. And a very senior lawyer was kind of teasing him and saying, I'll give you a dollar for every page that you get out of the government that's worthwhile. Well, it turns out that the young lawyer was absolutely right. We got 100,000 pages of documents from the U.S. government itself on the issue of torture and abuse of individuals in their custody. There you see that the argument, especially coming out of Rumsfeld and Cheney and Bush, that these are a couple of isolated incidents or that these are a couple of rogue soldiers or bad apple soldiers, just doesn't really hold up. The idea that you have 100,000 pages of government documents in the government's custody shows that this is a much more widespread, much more systemic than anyone had ever imagined. And what it showed, in fact, was that there was great debate, there was a roiling debate between the Department of Defense, the CIA, and the FBI on whether or not the appropriateness of the interrogation techniques, on whether or not they were going too far. And some of the first documents we got were actually from the FBI itself, where they were showing, or they were providing guidance to their FBI personnel in Guantanamo, specifically in this one case, to stand down from any of the interrogations where they felt that the Department of Defense or the military was going too far. In fact, one FBI agent called the use of torture techniques, he didn't even put it in quotation marks, he literally in his email, he said the use of these torture techniques raised serious concerns about the efficacy or the veracity of the information that they will ultimately glean. And so now, 100,000 pages later, we have a much fuller picture of the torture and abuse that has happened, especially at Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, and in Bagram.
Let me ask you about this big debate in the American Psychological Association. Yeah. Democracy Now! Went to San Francisco for the four-day convention, their annual convention, and broadcast from there. And in the midst of that, you wrote that letter to Sharon Brem, the president of the APA. Explain what your letter said.
Well, we wanted to be very clear. We want to exhort them to encourage their membership in the American Psychological Association to take a stance that would say that their members are not to participate in any of the interrogations that may use torture or abusive techniques, what are these advanced coercive techniques. And we wanted to be very clear on two fronts, frankly, Amy. One was we were calling to the morality, that the healers shouldn't be part of the tormentors, as we talk about at the end of the letter. That the American Psychological Association has always thought of itself as helping people grapple with difficulty, mental illness or mental issues or psychological problems, and that they should not be a part of the tormenting forces of government. And so we want to appeal to their ethical side. We also want to be clear that they have a legal liability. And frankly, as a legal organization, and as an organization that takes very seriously the need to hold people accountable, that if there are individuals, psychologists, doctors, who are involved in such techniques, they face potential civil and criminal liability.
We invited a spokesperson from the American Psychological Association on the program, but they did not respond to our repeated requests. At the center of the firestorm is Dr. Stephen Behnke, who's director of ethics at the APA. At the end of the group's annual conference, Dr. Behnke addressed a few hundred APA members gathered at a town hall meeting. The meeting was held after the APA's policymaking council voted to approve a resolution that prohibited involvement in interrogations that use at least 14 specified methods, including sleep deprivation, sexual humiliation, and mock executions. Dr. Behnke got on the stage to defend the resolution.
The passage I like to read says that be it resolved that the American Psychological Association affirms that there are no exceptional circumstances whatsoever, whether induced by a state of war or threat of war, internal political instability, or any other public emergency that may be invoked as a justification for torture or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment, including the invocation of laws, regulations, and orders. But I also want to be very clear that if you look at the language of the resolution, and again, I hope that everyone reads it, what it says is that this unequivocal condemnation includes all techniques defined as, and then it says, this unequivocal condemnation includes but is by no means limited to, so that there are specific techniques identified, but that is not a closed set, very explicitly not a closed set. One final point about the resolution, again, just encourage people to read it, but the Ethics Committee has been directed by counsel. It says, be it resolved that the APA Ethics Committee shall proceed forthwith in writing its casebook and commentary that shall set forth guidelines for psychology that are consistent with international human rights instruments. And then it actually specifies what those instruments are. The first is Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions.
That was Stephen Behnke. Stephen Behnke, ethics spokesperson for the American Psychological Association. Your response, ACLU Executive Director Anthony Romero.
Well, I think one of the things that's quite disconcerting about the debate, and I'd want to understand and study better the resolution that he just read, is that part of what's going on both within the government and it seems also within the American Psychological Association is this effort to redefine what is torture and to provide some wiggle room at the gray areas. If to be very clear, there are certain techniques that were completely off the books before 9/11, that there were techniques that were not ever to be authorized. Rumsfeld and others and within the military expanded the list of interrogation techniques. Ultimately, had to retract some of them because they had gone too far. And yet you find an effort right now to redefine what does, in fact, constitute torture, what constitutes abuse, what is cruel and humiliating treatment. And I think part of what we've got to be very clear about, and I think the American Psychological Association needs to grapple with, is what is its role?
The American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association have said that their members cannot participate at all.
Yes.
They rejected that possibility of a moratorium on psychologist involvement. And earlier in the day, before that town hall meeting, which was mainly just many angry psychologists from around the country decrying the decision of the APA Policymaking Council, but during the debate of the Policymaking Council, some of the top military brass was in attendance, perhaps none more so than Colonel Larry James. He was flown in from Cuba, from Guantanamo, where he served as the chief psychologist for the Joint Intelligence Group at Guantanamo Bay. He was also the first psychologist at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. An APA council representative himself, Colonel James, addressed the council members on Sunday as they were preparing to vote on a proposed resolution that would have prohibited psychologists from participating in interrogations at Guantanamo and other U.S. detention centers.
This is my second tour at Gitmo, Cuba. I was also the first psychologist at Abu Ghraib. I'm going to repeat what I said earlier. If we remove psychologists from these facilities, people are going to die. If we remove psychologists from these facilities, people are going to get hurt. One other thing I want to add, we've got young 27, 28, 29-year-old psychologists on the battlefield right now. If you support this amendment, those young psychologists are going to feel as though we've abandoned them, and they need our support right now. Thank you very much.
Soon after Colonel Larry James spoke, he was confronted by an APA member in the audience. Lori Wagner is a psychologist and a member of the APA Psychoanalysis Division. She took Colonel James to task.
I heard Colonel James say that if psychologists are not present in Guantanamo and other settings similar to it, that innocent lives will be lost. And I asked him what he meant by that, and he said the lives of detainees. And I would submit that if psychologists have to be there in order to keep detainees from being killed, that those conditions are so horrendous that the only moral and ethical thing to do is to protest it by leaving it.
Anthony Romero.
We have to go back to a categorical rejection of the torture and abuse and the use of techniques that humiliate detainees. There's no need to argue about the niceties of these definitions. There's no need to talk about whether waterboarding is or is not torture. Whether or not mock executions are or not torture. We need to go back to a point, Amy, where we as a nation ascribe to some core values that we do not allow people to be poorly treated in our custody. And I think the questions that about if individuals are dying in Guantanamo, for the gentleman who spoke from the Guantanamo base, it's because many of them are trying to commit suicide because they have no hope, because we've eliminated the right of habeas corpus. They have no access to the judicial system. No access to their family members, but they're kind of detained. I've been to Guantanamo, and I've been for the first round of military commission proceedings. It is not what the government describes it to be. No matter how good a face they try to put on the detention center at Guantanamo and the military commission proceedings, it is a travesty, and it does not uphold to the best of American values. And we have to go back to a point where we look ourselves in the mirror as Americans and say, who are we as a people? What do we stand for? We stand for some core values, the right to habeas corpus, the right to be treated well, the right to be treated humanely, to equal protection under the law, the right to due process. And that's often what our government officials forget to remind themselves of in their jobs.
We're talking to Anthony Romero, executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union. His book is In Defense of Our America, The Fight for Civil Liberties in the Age of Terror. He wrote it with Dina Temple Raston. We'll be back with him in a minute. NUPA by Bill Laswell here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest, Anthony Romero, executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union, has just written a book in defense of our America. You talk about John Wilker Lynn in this book. Some people may have already forgotten who he is, a young man who's now in jail.
Right. Known as the American Taliban. That's how we got to know him in the early part of 2001. And I thought it was important, as we wrote this book, about stories. These are the stories of ordinary people that bring to life some of the major principles around civil liberties. And the idea is to root it in a personal narrative that's like a novel. And what better character or what better a personage to focus on than John Wilker Lynn? He was apprehended on the battlefield in December of 2001. America was still reeling from the effects of the World Trade Center attack and the attacks on the Pentagon. It's just been 3 months earlier. We were just beginning the war in Afghanistan. And here you have a young 20-some-odd-year-old American who was picked up on the battlefield in Afghanistan. And most Americans just scratched their heads initially and said, what was an American from Northern California, brought up in Roman Catholic family, what was he doing fighting for the Taliban? And in the book, what I tried to do with my colleague Dina Temple Raston from NPR to write the book was to provide the answers to those basic questions, the questions my mom wanted to know. What was he doing there? Well, how did he end up there? What was he trying to accomplish? Why did his parents let him go? I mean, this is a question I think that most parents would ask. And so we tell the story from the perspective of his mom and dad. His mom and dad actually were enormously generous. Marilyn and Frank spent a great deal of time with me and with my co-author, and giving us access to the family narrative in a way they hadn't before. They've been very reticent to speak publicly on the press. I think much of it had to do with the shock of the media attention that happened after John was apprehended. And the story about why he was there is still one that the book does not provide an apology or excuses or rationalization. It was a colossal mistake for John Wilker Lynn to be fighting on the battlefield for the Taliban. He was a young man who found Islam as a way to find purpose in life. He was struggling as a young adolescent with a stomach ailment, and he was homeschooled. He was very reclusive. He was struggling to be a young man growing into a young man's body. And he went to go see the movie Malcolm X, Spike Lee's movie, and something sparked in him. He began to develop an interest in Islam, and his teachers began to assign him papers on Islam, and his parents were a little bit perplexed. They were Roman Catholic, but they were glad that their son had found some purpose in life. And later on, as he developed an interest in Islam and he wanted to study Arabic, and he fully converted by the age of 18, he went and talked with his mom and said, I'd like to study Arabic at a place where I can chant the Quran and be much more of a devout Muslim. And his mom and he did the research to figure out what was the best language center, and they decided on a place in Yemen, and off he went. And that's where he made a series of wrong turns. I mean, in one of the language centers, he moved from one school to another. He got involved with a much more, ideological group of students who you could imagine. They have this this white American blonde kid in the middle of their midst, and they keep testing his mettle, saying, well, if you really want to be a Muslim brother, you've got to go fight the jihad. And so this young man decided in a way that that I think is still an enormous mistake, to go fight for the war in Afghanistan and to fight the jihad. We have to remember also the Taliban has this also ambivalent relationship with the American government throughout its years. I mean, at the same time that John Walker Lind was debating whether or not to go fight for the Taliban, we, the American people, were providing $43 million of subsidy, of direct taxpayer money, for opium eradication to the Taliban government.
In fact, Taliban leaders came to the United States and to Texas.
Texas, and visited with Mr. Bush, and we have great pictures of Mr. Bush. And later on, we made a decision, as a foreign policy decision, that they were not allies that we wanted, and we went to war. And so John Walker Lind got picked up in all this. And so the story doesn't, the story of telling that story is not to excuse it by any way, but it's to provide a context. The civil liberties issues happen after John Walker Lind is picked up by the Americans. And here where I think that's most relevant from a civil liberties perspective is some of the key questions that in December 2001, his parents, when they find out through an MSNBC website that their son is on the front lines in Afghanistan and picked up by the Americans, they hired the best lawyer money can buy. They hired Jim Brosnahan. He's a great criminal defense lawyer. If I ever got arrested walking out of your studio because of all the heresy and the anti-government statements I've been making on the show, I would call Jim. He's an amazing criminal defense lawyer. But from day one, they hired him. And Jim would not have access to his client, even after repeated requests, both in writing and in verbally, to the Defense Department, to the FBI, and elsewhere, to have access to his client. It would be too little too late. John would have made statements that would later come back and haunt him in a court of law. And in fact, at one point, there's an exchange that we were able to unearth and show in the book of an FBI ethics lawyer that was cautioning people in Afghanistan not to interrogate John Walker Lind without presence of his counsel. And yet they went ahead and did it anyway. So that was one, the access to counsel. Two, John Walker Lind was tortured. And we should be very clear about it. He's not able to say so because that was part of the agreement in his plea agreement with the government. He had to say that he would not assert around torture or abuse in his detention center while in U.S. custody. But they retained a bullet in his right thigh for almost 2 weeks while they interrogated him, even though he had access to an army field surgeon who could have readily removed the bullet. You remember the pictures. Some of the pictures are in the book, in the center of the book. You remember the pictures of him being strapped to a gurney completely naked with the duct tape across his body. He was kept in a metal container outside for 2 days. You have questions raised about also humiliating photographs. There's one of the things that we were able to unearth in the ACLU litigation using FOIA, again, it's Democracy's X-ray, as I was saying before, is that there was a series of more than 100 pages of government investigation reports on a series of photographs and videos taken of John Walker Lind. Because there was a photograph where they had him, again, blindfolded, and they had an expletive written on his blindfold, and all the soldiers posing behind him with their thumbs up, like it's some military souvenir. And the photograph, when the higher-ups found out about it, destroyed it, and destroyed a video. And then someone in Washington got very concerned about the humiliating photographs, and then required a series of investigations of the photographs around John Walker Lind. And we at the ACLU were able to get those investigative reports. Now think about those 3 points. Lack of access to counsel would be later the questions that would be raised at Guantanamo. The torture and abuse of John Walker Lind with the bullet in his thigh and the environmental manipulation, sleep deprivation, would come back again to raise its head in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. The humiliating photographs, those were harbingers of things to come. Those would remind us later on of the questions around Lindy England, you know, with the same pose. Soldiers posing with detainees as a way to humiliate them. And had we stopped and asked the questions in December of 2001 about the access to counsel, about the torture and abuse, about the humiliating photographs, had we, the American people and the American leadership, been willing to ask the tough questions at that time, maybe we wouldn't have been so quick to make the mistakes we later on made in 2003, 2004, and still make today.
John Walker Lynn now 20 years in jail. Others have been freed that have raised questions. His parents very afraid that this was such a charged climate. In fact, it wasn't his first, one of his first hearings was on September 11th, the anniversary.
They were planning to start the trial, actually the full trial of John Walker Lynn on September 11th. John Ashcroft was leading the charge, using John Walker Lynn as a poster boy for the war on terror. And ultimately, what's ironic that most people don't realize, and we point out in the book, is the fact that John Walker Lynn is now serving 20 years in a supermax prison in Colorado, I believe. He ultimately has only been... he only pled guilty to charges that have nothing to do with terrorism at all. One is because he traveled to a country that was on an embargoed list. There was a law that was amended and signed into law by President Clinton, the same law that would ban me from going right now to Iraq or to Cuba or to elsewhere. And one is for being a soldier of a foreign army. But all the other charges that had to do with terrorism, about being providing material support to a terrorist group, or the death of Mr. Spahn, which was the first CIA agent to have been killed in the war in Afghanistan. All of those other charges were dropped. And then you compare that sentence of John Walker Lind serving 20 years, and you compare that to the Australian Taliban, the fellow Mr. Hicks, who was held in Guantanamo, and they tried to prosecute him through the military commission proceedings and have failed miserably. Mr. Hicks will now serve 9 months in Australia. And perhaps the most galling of them is Mr. Hamdi, the Saudi Arabian American citizen of Saudi descent, the case that went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And Mr. Hamdi is scot-free in Saudi Arabia. Ultimately, the government just stripped him of his citizenship. I tried to interview Mr. Hamdi on the phone. He's very busy with his family and his personal life. He asked me for money for the interview. I declined, of course. And so you have these three very mixed sentences about John Walker Lynn on the one hand, Mr. Hamdi is living his life.
They were afraid he would get the death penalty.
They were afraid he was going to get the death penalty.
I wanted to switch gears to spying, something the ACLU has been challenging now for years. Talk about the ACLU's involvement, the challenging, why you sued even on behalf of your own attorneys.
Well, I think one of the things we're most concerned about is we don't know the full extent of the domestic surveillance that's being conducted on people who have done or are doing nothing wrong. And so when we first heard about the NSA, the National Security Agency spying program, and the effort to track the communications of Americans, where the president completely bypassed Congress, here we are debating the niceties of the Patriot Act and whether or not there ought to be changes to the law, and the men and women in Congress are debating what changes to the laws were necessary. And the president basically said to the men and women in Congress, go, boys and girls, go play with your marbles. I'm going to authorize this program in secret without your authorization. He completely bypasses the federal court system, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, set up as of 1978 as a way to provide intelligence.
Often seen as a rubber stamp on almost every request.
But it's some form of a check and balance. It was ironic because, Amy, for so many years we were arguing that it was an insufficient check. And here we are arguing for the need to retain even that anemic check that in place. And so we brought a suit when we first found out about the NSA program. We brought the suit on behalf of the ACLU and a number of the lawyers at the ACLU. Also on behalf of Josh Dreitel, who represents Mr. Hicks at Guantanamo. Also on behalf of some of the academics and journalists. We have Christopher Hitchens, who's one of our clients in the lawsuit. Barney Rubin, who's the foremost expert on the Taliban, someone who is a professor at NYU, has been to Afghanistan 35, 40-some-odd times, talks regularly with the leadership of the Taliban, has known them for decades, the types of individuals that are likely to be the subject of surveillance by the U.S. government. In each of these cases, we've identified individuals who have a well-founded fear and whose work and whose circumstances will bring them into contact with the types of people the government would want to be listening to. And so we brought the suit. Most of your viewers and your listeners would know that we won at the initial level, at the federal district court level, and then we lost at the Court of Appeals level on these questions around standing, which is a legal nicety where it's almost Orwellian in this case, because you have to be able to prove that that you're the subject of surveillance to be able to demonstrate that you have the standing to challenge its constitutionality. Now, of course, there's only the government knows who's the subject of surveillance. And we can only assert what we believe is a well-founded fear and some concrete harm that's been done in terms of a chilling effect, in terms of affecting the inability for instance, our lawyers to confer openly with their clients or their family members. We are very reluctant to now have conversations that we are not sure can be maintained in terms of attorney-client privilege.
And the latest legislation, just before Congress went out in session, that the Democrats joined with the Republicans in affirming and passing around spying?
It's outrageous. It's, in one word, it's outrageous. And I rarely use that word because it's such hyperbole. And the Democrats didn't join. The Democrats led. Because let's be very clear, the House leader and the Senate leader, Ms. Pelosi and Mr. Reid, could have stopped that legislation from happening. They were the ones who handled the calendar of Congress. As the party in power, they could have stopped it from being enacted. And let's be very clear that it's not just joining or being complicit, it's leading of sorts, I guess. And what this FISA fix and this change further even more greatly guts the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
And the telecommunications companies exonerates them. What about these companies working with the government and providing access to the phones? Well,
that's one of the major battles, because right now there's a strong effort to provide immunity to the companies and to hold them completely harm-free because of the lawsuits that we and others have filed against AT&T and Verizon, against some of the international the internet providers, because clearly they have violated some of their own consumer privacy policies, and they can be open up to consumer litigation. There could be civil damages. There are certainly questions around some of the criminal prosecutions that are underway, and for us the whole question around the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and the fact that this recent law was pushed through again with very little debate, very little understanding about what, in fact, was necessary. One of the things we did recently in the last week or so, we went to one of the arguments that was posited by the government as necessary for this change in the law was a ruling from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court that they said impeded their ability to conduct good international surveillance. So we went to the court, and actually we filed a brief that we first filed, and the government just responded just last Friday, and we have another 2 weeks to reply to the government, where we say if this court ruling was so critical to the need to amend the law, at least the American people ought to at least see parts of that ruling.
We only have 30 seconds. Put today's time, what we're going through now, in context. How serious is it?
I think it's as serious as what we saw in the 1940s. I think it's even greater than in the 50s. And it's a war without end. And the difficulty we have is that we will never know the full extent to which our civil liberties have been abridged. And in a war that won't come to a public, decisive end, I worry that this can change the whole character of how we live and experience our civil rights and civil liberties for generations to come.
Anthony Romero, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union and co-author of the book In Defense of Our America: The Fight for Civil Liberties in the Age of Terror. And that does it for our broadcast. I head to Stanford University in Palo Alto today. I'll be at Memorial Auditorium tonight at 8 o'clock with the former Secretary of State George Shultz, with environmentalist Paul Ehrlich and others for a major discussion on the environment and global warming. Then on Friday, we'll be in Atlanta at the Carter Center. If you have questions for President Carter, you can email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Hovda Kadus, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Matei, Anjali Kamat, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Carrie Mache, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Noguera, our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Jose Miranda, Travis Collins, Samantha Chambly, Vesta Godarz. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.